That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. Today we hear from the author of a new memoir that tells not only her own story, but the story of her home country, Albania, too, during a period of cultural and political upheaval. Here's the journalist and author Luke Harding, foreign correspondent for The Guardian, with more.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Intelligence Squared Plus event with me, Luke Harding. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce our guest tonight, Leia Upi, professor in political theory in the government department of the London School of Economics, and of course, author of the acclaimed new book, Free, which we'll be talking about this evening. Leia, here is your book. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. It was a great pleasure and privilege to review it for The Observer. I mean, I think it's one of the most astonishing memoirs I've read, certainly a nonfiction book of the year. And you've had great praise from, well, from me, from the Daily Mail, from readers, from everybody. And I just, I mean, looking at your CV and your biography, I mean, you've written books on Kant, the philosopher, I think, too. You've written sort of philosophical academic works. And then you write this dazzling, funny memoir. I mean, why the shift in genre from scholarship to personal?
Thank you. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining and to Luke for reading the book and for your kind words and for your kind review. So it wasn't intentional. I guess like all good things, or a lot of good things happen, aren't intentional. I initially planned to write a book on freedom, and I wanted to talk about freedom both as a moral ideal and as it's institutionalized, as it appears in different political systems and the extent to which these institutions reflect freedom or betray freedom. And I wanted to write about it in connection to liberal and socialist traditions, because one of my longstanding academic, theoretical, philosophical convictions has been that freedom is the common core of these traditions, both liberalism and socialism. Although a lot of people tend to think of liberalism as committed to this idea of freedom and socialism as committed to equality, I think what the socialist tradition in political thought does is to really radicalize the liberal idea of freedom and to talk about the ways in which in capitalist economic systems, it actually produces margins of unfreedom and produces oppression and exploitation in ways that don't really reflect this ideal of freedom that is at the heart of it as a philosophical tradition. So I wanted to write about ideas, and I wanted to write about real world institutions and also how these ideas in some ways get distorted or reflected in real life. And I started thinking about examples because I was going to write a book for the mass market. It wasn't going to be an academic book, so I wanted to communicate to a wide readership. And as I began to write this book, the more I thought about it, the more I thought about examples, the more they came from Albania. And not just Albania, but my own early life in Albania. And so, in fact, I had memories of childhood and then teenage years, and all these reflections on freedom were somehow appeared one way or another in characters and so on. And so that's how it became more and more personal, and the project then took on a life of its own. And I was then abandoned to these characters that I remembered and began to use different material, stopped reading philosophy books, started going back to the diaries that I had kept as a child. And so then it was an archaeological project in a way of recovery and discovery of an old self that I had kind of forgotten almost about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And you start with your 11-year-old old self. I mean, the beginning of the book, for those who haven't read it yet, I mean, I guess we can do spoilers at this point, but you it's December 1990, and you're on your way back from school, and you are hugging Stalin. I mean, not literally Stalin, obviously he's dead by that point, but hugging a municipal statue of Stalin. I mean, the whole passage is surreal and funny and mordant and arresting. And then suddenly you hear these cries in the distance. I mean, tell us about this incident and why you began your book with that.
It was in December 1990, which is when things began to change in Albania. So 1990 rather than 1989 was the year of shifts and revolution for Albania. Albania was in 1990 a very isolated country. It had been isolated for most of the second half of the 20th century, but increasingly isolated. It began as an ally of Yugoslavia, then of the Soviet Union, then of China. And by the time in which I was growing up in the 80s, we were completely on our own. And the rhetoric in school was that we were on our own because we were the only country left on earth that was still committed to the ideals of communism and to socialism as the transition to communism. And so in moral education, we were told about how everybody else around us had betrayed the legacy of Stalin, but there was this one proud nation in the Balkans which was still holding on to Stalin and holding on to the tradition and promoting these communist ideals. And in fact, the slogan was that Albania was the anti-imperialist lighthouse of the world. And I was fundamentally convinced of this. And in fact, you know, we were told in school that we had it hard, that we were isolated because we were on the right side. And every time someone is on the right side, they're always fighting with the rest of the world because there's all kinds of motives that make people not want to do the right thing. And so when this protest happened in 1990, there had been a few, so the year between 1989 and 1990 was a strange year for Albania because we were aware that things were changing in the rest of the world. But because we had been so cut off and so isolated from Eastern Europe, and because the discourse in Albania was that these East European countries had begun to abandon socialism long time ago, and in fact Albania had left the Warsaw Pact in 1968 when the Soviet Union invaded Prague, so there was a criticism of these real world other socialist states, which was part of the everyday discourse in Albania, which meant that all these changes that were swiping Eastern Europe around that time, we didn't feel that were changes that were touching Albania in a way. We felt kind of left out. Except things began to change in Albania as well. And somehow, you know, as things happen, when revolutions happen, you can never say there was this moment in which something changed. For me, the moment in which something changed was the moment in which I had stumbled in a protest by mistake coming out of school and just going, taking the wrong way. And this is all written in my diary of the time. And I started with that because I started with this diary and I remembered this episode of me hiding behind this statue of Stalin. And I was really scared because there was this people shouting on the street and dogs barking and following them. And I had gone to hide behind Stalin because I couldn't see anywhere elsewhere to hide. But when I was hiding, I was also remembering my teachers. We did this class, moral education, in school, who kept saying, you know, Stalin had this very strange smile. You couldn't really see it because it was hidden by his mustache, but he would smile with his eyes. And somehow, I had written about this in my diary as well, about Stalin's smile and his mustache and so on. And I remember when I was hiding behind this statue, at one point I lifted my head to see whether Stalin was really smiling with his eyes. And I was completely shocked because he had been decapitated. So the statue had lost its head. And this was, for me, the moment of revolution, was a moment of seeing that somebody had stolen Stalin's head. And, you know, it's really hard to explain and to kind of convey to people how you could be really attached to this figure for all your life and think this is one of the most important people in the history of humanity and a moral leader and a kind of moral ideal. And then somehow you realize that your fellow citizens or someone has out of the blue gone and done something which was completely inconceivable. And why would they do that? And in addition to that, they were shouting freedom and democracy. And I also remember thinking, well, why are they shouting freedom and democracy? We have a lot of freedom. We have a lot of democracy. So that was a moment for me where I began to think that something was not as it appeared to be.
And I mean, you write beautifully about how at that moment, at that point, age 11, you were a believer, you were a pioneer, you were an outstanding student. But your parents, I mean, we'll talk more about them, but their relationship to power structures and to politics was always more ambiguous and evasive and strange. And there's a sort of mystery threading through the first half of the book about your family biography, which You tell delightfully, and again, I don't know if you want to sort of, you know, explain it or not, but it turns out you were not quite the person you thought you were.
Yeah, and this word biography played a really important role because it was the term that we invoked to explain things about people. And we would distinguish between people with good biographies and with bad biographies, people with stained biographies and people with clean biographies. And I remember that I was surrounded by this word in school and through television, at home and so on. And I didn't quite know what it meant. And as with all words where you don't really know what they mean, you're also afraid to ask because I think it's so obvious that, you know, you shouldn't be asking about it. But it had something to do with your family background. And one thing that I reflected on my family background from very early on as a child, because I knew that there was something about me that was different, you know, in communist Albania. The one thing that was different and really stood out was the fact that my French was my first language. So people spoke French and my grandmother spoke French to me when I was growing up. And this was not common. And it was not common, not just because nobody would speak to their children in French, it was very unusual, but also because my grandmother wasn't French. She'd never been to France. She didn't have any relatives in France. She spoke French with an Albanian accent. And I know this because whenever we watched television and there were French films with subtitles, I could see that her accent was different from the actors of sort of French people. But somehow I had been brought up speaking French and I knew there was something to do with my family. And my grandmother always said, oh, it's because we like the French Revolution or, you know, you like Les Misérables, which we used to read at school and there was a puppet show with Cosette and so on. So there were always these kind of cultural reasons. And then another thing that really stood out was that in communist Albania, everyone had photos of Enver Hoxha in their living room. And I remember I was completely obsessed with why we didn't have a photo of Enver Hoxha. And my parents kept finding excuses and saying, well, we need a nice frame. We've ordered the frame, but it's not coming. We're waiting for your birthday. We're waiting for this to happen. So somehow it was never the right time to put a photo of Enver Hoxha. I remember, especially after his death, I was completely troubled by the fact that we didn't have a photo of Enver Hoxha. And I was so committed, really wanted to meet him. When he died, all the work collectives in Albania went to pay tribute to the grave. And I was begging my father to take me when his work would go, and somehow he didn't bring me. And I remember all these sort of childhood moments where I don't remember exactly how, you know, the lead up to these events, but I do remember this sensation of my parents were letting me down because I had this commitment to communism from school and in general, I was really persuaded. And my parents somehow were very, quite strange about it. They wouldn't say, don't do it, or they wouldn't say, we don't want a photo of Enver Hoxha. In fact, they would, every time I brought it out explicitly, they would say, of course we want it, of course we love Enver Hoxha, and so on. But they actually never did it and never brought the photo.
But there's a kind of mysterious sort of ghost in your family biography. There was another Upi who was a kind of notorious fascist collaborator, traitor, and so on. And you were sort of confidently told when you were young that you had nothing to do with him, that he was not related to you, but that also turned out to be slightly more complicated than that, didn't it?
Yeah, this also was an yearly recurrence, actually, not just because we studied about him in history classes in school. He was the equivalent of the Maréchal Pétain, so he was the equivalent of the kind of the head of the Vichy government who would have handed over the Albanian crown from King Zog, who was in power at that point in the late 30s, to the Italian fascists, who had already colonized Albania de facto, but not officially. So there were all these years in the 30s where Albania was increasingly subject to Italian influence, but there was this pivotal moment where at some point the Italians invaded, and this character was there to give the crown of the king from the king who had been his former collaborator to these new Italian masters. And this was, and he was in every history class, as you can imagine, in communist Albania, talking about fascism and the resistance and so on. Every Albanian had basically had a family relative or a grandfather who fought in the resistance. And then there was this, we didn't have anyone who fought in the resistance. That was one problem. The second problem was that not only did we not have anyone who was fighting in the war, but also the only person that we could relate to in history because we had the same surname was this fascist collaborator. And so this was a huge source of disappointment. And my family always said to me, we're not related. He just happens to have the same surname. He also happened to have the same name as my father. So it was name and surname was the same thing. So I could not be asked about this character every year. But somehow I had to explain to my school friends that we didn't have anything to do with him and that it was just a coincidence, until it turned out in 1990, when things changed in Albania, that it wasn't a coincidence, that in fact he was my great-grandfather, and that my father was called the same as his granddad, basically, because also this is what they did in these sort of big families. They would call after, you know, ancestors in a way. So yeah, that was one of the mysteries of childhood eventually revealed in 1990, which was really, again, a big surprise and blow in a way.
And I mean, you write wonderfully about your childhood, but also your book is a complex and delightful portrait of a marriage and your grandmother as well, who's this sort of luminous presence throughout the book and to whom you dedicate it. And I mean, I just sort of wonder, you know, how did you feel about sort of reconstructing your parents' conversations and their adult relationship, which I mean, they were both high achieving, but in some ways, as you tell it, somewhat incompatible, almost sort of dialectically incompatible, you could say.
Yeah, the way I was brought to it was I was always sensitive to these different ideas of freedom and to the nuances of talking about freedom, actually. So I got to the book with characters, as I said, and with personal histories and with details and family stories and so on, and family conflicts as well. So it turned out to be a very different book from what I had initially imagined. But what I had initially imagined was a book on freedom and the different ways in which people talk about freedom and the ways in which they understand freedom and how they project it to different social systems. And when I then began to think about characters, I realized that one of the reasons I had been so attracted to these very different ideas of freedom, and in fact, one of the reasons why I find myself being really tolerant of also people who have completely opposite views politically to mine, was that in fact, I had lived in this family where all this completely opposite political opinions had coexisted, not just in the family among relatives, but actually in a marriage. So my parents couldn't be more different from each other. And in fact, when I reflected on this later on, I realized that my mother had what one might call this very liberal, classical liberal idea of negative freedom. So she always thought you are free if nobody stops you from doing things like traveling, going somewhere, or dressing in a certain way, or saying certain things in public. And this animates all her struggles in the book. And in fact, it also animates all the struggles of all the Albanians who thought they were leaving behind state socialism because they wanted to leave behind state interference in a way. And my father, on the other hand, had this very, very different idea of freedom, which I associated later on to positive freedoms, this idea that it's not just about being free from something, but you also have to have the freedom to achieve a certain conception of yourself and to realize certain opportunities. And so it's not enough, you know, and he always said this, it wasn't enough to be stopped from doing certain things. You are only free if you have opportunities to also realize these ambitions. And in fact, his dilemmas became particularly relevant in the second half of the book and in sort of in the Albania of post-1990, because he had grown up with this very idealistic account of what freedom and what kind of society he wanted to live in. And he thought Albania was going to become that society until he was in a position of responsibility in post-1990 Albania. And he was the CEO of the port of Durrës. And he was in charge of enacting these structural reforms that came to Albania with the help of the World Bank and the IMF and this idea of sort of shock therapy and quick liberalization of the country. And he was in a position of power. So he actually had to make decisions about making people redundant. And he found this extremely, extremely burdensome. Whereas for my mother, it was, this is just the cost of transition. The market requires that people be laid off. They will find other opportunities. Everyone needs to fend off for themselves. It's nobody's job to protect these people. My dad really struggled with it because he couldn't accept that, you know, the state could just leave people or an institution could just leave people unprotected and defenseless. And I remember, because these were years in which he was kind of anxious as a person. My mother was very different. She was very confident and she was completely fearless. And my dad has always been very anxious and very worried about things. And this was when he was in this position of responsibility, the conflict between the two became most vivid because they had such different worldviews, which were clashing in this new society that we were living in.
But the way you write them, I mean, they're dramatically kind of realized characters with novelistic dimensions and just beautifully observed. I mean, your father with his asthma puffer waiting for you to come back from the march, your mother, you know, a bit passive aggressively doing the dishes and cleaning the attic and so on. I mean, it's all delightfully told. And, you know, the thing that I think, I mean, as well as the ideas, which are kind of, you know, brilliant and interesting, it's just the comic sensibility. I mean, your sheer sense of humour and the wonderful irony with which you tell this personal story. I mean, where does that come from, your humor? Is that something you inherited, or is it from a family member? I mean, how do you explain it?
I think it's maybe in the background somehow. I think both in the family background. So my father was very ironic, and he always made a lot of jokes, and he had this very kind of irony and comic approach to very tragic things. And so one of the things that I remember from very early on in my life was my dad had all these anti-imperialist jokes. And so the first time in which I heard about the Middle Eastern conflict and the problem of refugees in the Middle East was when I had friends over for sleepovers, and we would lay out mattresses on the floor, and he would say, "Oh, good night, Palestinian Khan." And I had no idea. This was really, I was like 5 or 6 or something. We had cousins over, and I remember thinking, what is a Palestinian camp and so on. So this is my first kind of socialization into political issues, was this through this approach which he had, which he eventually even almost elaborated later on, where he said to me, "Well, you know, if you're in a very censored society, in a very oppressive state, and you have to find ways to express yourself, irony and jokes are one way in which you could almost just about do it. It's not, you always have to be very careful with jokes, and you know, you have to know where you make them and who you make them with and how you make them. But irony, I think, is a very revealing attitude to life and to a lot of things, actually. So this has been partly in the family. And I think it's also maybe a little bit in kind of Balkan East European culture, is this approach to, which is almost kind of ironic / absurd to very tragic things. People make jokes about death all the time, and they have this very dark humor, which I think is a way of bringing together very, very serious issues, but in a way that doesn't lead people to just kind of flagellate themselves and be just depressed and nihilistic, but to somehow find a way of saying, look, you need to somehow cope with stuff and get by. And yeah.
I mean, your book is divided into two very distinct halves. So where you're in socialist Albania, and then you're in a sort of, you know, post-socialist neoliberal world, which is completely different. But I mean, just before we talk about the sort of second half, there is that kind of moment when you're 11 in the summer of 1990, where you're going to pioneer camp for the last time, and it sounds. Almost kind of, you know, prelapsarian. I mean, you're doing, you know, physics, you're swimming, the older kids are kind of flirting for the first time, you're camping out, sunshine. I mean, is it that you've made it ideal, or actually was it ideal at that moment?
I remember it as ideal. And I mean, I don't know. I think it's because I never, as a child, suffered from political oppression in a way. You know, when you're a child, you don't have political opinions, and you don't think of censorship in that political way. You think about security and the things that... Someone asked me recently if I was afraid of anything during communism in Albania. And I think they meant, were you afraid of anything politically? And when I tried to think about things I had been afraid of, I could think of dogs and drunken people, but nothing really to do with, you know, with the system or with society or with the police. So I felt like my life was very secure. And when I remember these moments of childhood pre-awareness, before knowing what was going on in my family, they were these moments of the pioneer camp and the queues. And they weren't memories without scarcity, because I also remember that, you know, I was, for example, having these fights because I wanted to eat honey, and I only liked to eat honey. And my parents were saying, "No, you can't have honey. There's no honey in the shops. You can only have jam or fig jam," which was the kind of staple that you could find in every shop. It was fig jam. And I hated fig jam. So I remember these moments of sort of fighting. And my grandmother had this expression, which I eventually later discovered came from Brecht, where she said it was a kind of subversion of Brecht. You know, Brecht says first comes food and then comes morality. And my grandmother had reverted that into first comes morality and then food. And I eventually had become convinced of this, that, you know, we didn't have to worry too much about not having food and having long queues, as long as it was a moral society, which Albania, I thought, obviously was. And so, so when I think about these episodes of my childhood, as I say, there were conflicts and there was scarcity, but there is a sense in which I think every child accommodates to the constraints with which they live. And I sometimes now look at my kids, for example, in a traffic light, when we're stuck in a traffic, you know, when we were traveling, we rented a car somewhere, we end up being stuck for hours. And they're in a queue and they're just waiting there. And it doesn't lead them to question fundamentally the system in which they live. You know, the fact that there are these traffic lights and there is this long queue of cars and you could be there for 2 hours. You just absorb it and accept it as a fact of life. And I think it was the same thing for me. There were all these queues about food, and we didn't have milk, and we had to get up at 4 in the morning to queue for milk. And they were just, you know, what you live with and what life has. And so when I remembered afterwards, it's It's not that it's idyllic because I made it idyllic or because I wanted to present it in a way that was sort of making people feel nostalgic, but this is just how I remembered it and how I had written about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you were you aware that your family was quite unusual? I mean, you spoke fluent French, which was pretty odd at that time. Your parents were intellectuals whose lives were sort of semi-ruined by their kind of backstories, by their biographies. I mean, your grandmother, you know, attended King Zog's wedding. I mean, you were not your typical kid. And there's also some wonderful footage, I think you tweeted, of you being interviewed by, I can't remember if it's an Italian or a French TV crew, as a kind of small kid. I mean, you were a bit unusual. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. No, I was unusual. I mean, I didn't know that I was unusual. Obviously, there was a sense in which that, as I say, with through the French or through the kind of family culture or through the way in which my parents, for example, never hit me, and this was unusual because a lot of children were hit by parents. And I mean, it wasn't like violent, but there were certain norms in my family, which I think it's fair to say they weren't the conventions of Albanian society, and that stood out certainly. So I knew I stood out, but I didn't know for what reason I stood out. And it was never conveyed to me that there was a different political identity, which I carried with me, which came from my parents and my family background, my grandmother especially, that was the reason for why I stood out. And so I had grown up with this sense of not quite belonging, but since I was very committed ideologically, I was making up for this sense of not belonging that came from the family by being even more committed in a way to the society and by being kind of good student. And I think that I was equally subjected in a way to the influence of the family and of the state. And it's only in 1990 that it became clear that these two influences were pulling in opposite directions. Before that, they seemed to be going in the same direction. And it was only in 1990 that it caused a sort of almost like an identity crisis.
Yeah, I mean, there's this kind of great revelation, isn't there, as the regime crumbles, that you discover who you are and where you came from. And what's interesting, what's compelling about the second half of the book is that it certainly feels like things get worse. I mean, to some extent for you personally, I mean, there's a chapter which is just your adolescent diary. I mean, we all wrote those, but yours is done against the background, not just of kind of, you know, teenage crushes, but of Kalashnikovs being fired in the street outside and civil war. And Albania seems to fall into darkness. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think there was a sense in which what happened in 1990 was that there was this fundamental belief and faith in this new society that would come and that would deliver freedom. And for a lot of people who had lived under communism, like my parents, who had lived all their lives under communism, like my parents and my grandmother before that, there was a sense in which the transition brought its sacrifices, and these sacrifices just needed to be made in the name of this better world, even though it was very obvious and very plain to everyone to see that the transition had its costs. A lot of people were losing jobs and a lot of state enterprises were closing down. There was lots of migration outside Albania. And then eventually there were these fraudulent pyramid Ponzi schemes, which asked people to put their investments in hope for high savings, and then they all collapsed. And so in 97, the whole country basically ended up in something close to civil war because of this financial collapse. So there, throughout the 90s, there were these moments of darkness and a sense in which the securities had gone, but the new freedoms hadn't quite arrived, or they hadn't quite arrived for everyone. And what differed, I think, in my case from that of my parents and my grandmother was that for them, these were all transition costs and sacrifices that you had to make because because freedom had a cost and because we'd had this very hard life under communism. And so now we just had to kind of put up with one last effort. And to me, it resembled very much the rhetoric of the last years of communism in Albania, where we were increasingly poor and increasingly, you know, there was scarcity and there were queues and things weren't working. It was very obvious that we weren't working. But there was a rhetoric and a discourse around the fact that, well, it's because we are the only country that is committed to communism and it's because of socialism. This freedom, and we want freedom to work for everyone. So I could see, in a way, I was putting the two systems in parallel and kind of assessing them equally critically in a way which my parents weren't doing, because for them this was something that had been promised all their lives, and most of their lives had been spent in hardship, and now it was just a question of kind of wrapping up and making one final effort. Whereas for me, half of my life had been under communism, and I didn't remember the brutality of it because I just hadn't lived it and I hadn't perceived it firsthand like that. And then the second half was going through just growing up. And part of the, as you say, part of the discomfort of growing up is the anxiety and the insecurity and the kind of discovery of the world. But the other was that the world that I was coming to discover was not a pretty world to look at, because my friends were leaving. There was sex trafficking. There was drug traffics everywhere. A lot of people had to make a living out of whatever they could, because the state, they knew the state wasn't protecting them. And so they began to take up these jobs that they all considered as, they were all mentioned as normal employments. You know, when we said someone was doing drugs, it was as though you'd said in communism, you'd say someone is a bus driver or someone is a nurse. And now you'd say, well, someone is just going up and down the pavements in Italy, or someone is doing cigarettes or things like that, or someone is smuggling people. So all of these things where there was no sense of moral assessment, or there are no moral hierarchies in a way. People would just do whatever they could to survive. And this is the world in which I was maturing. And in 97, that world really kind of came, everything almost concentrated in this image of brutality and state collapse, which was in some ways similar to 1990 because it felt like a systemic breakdown. But in other ways, it's even worse, because in 1990, there was this idea that things are changing and there is hope. And in 1997, as far as I could make out, there was not even hope, because there wasn't a new system that you could transition to. It was just that same system that you had to somehow live with. And that was what I found really hard, and which made me, I guess, existentially question a lot of things. And in fact, I had to decide, this was a year in which I had to do my, I was doing my A-levels, and I had to decide what to do at university. And I was so paralyzed about the future that I couldn't think of a single profession that I wanted to commit to, which is why I ended up doing philosophy, because it wasn't a profession. It was like, you just ask questions, you know? you professionally learn to ask good questions. And the reason I did it, it's because I couldn't see myself as either a doctor or a lawyer or an economist. All of these things, what sense does it make to be an economist when the whole society is collapsing around you? And what sense does it make to be a lawyer when there is no law and order outside you, because there's Kalashnikovs outside your window and there is no, you know, the state has no control over the use of force anymore. So all of these professions that are somehow connected to careers and career structures and trodden paths just made no sense. They all looked really absurd and like there was no value to any of them, which is, as I say, why I ended up doing philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, you give the impression that these two systems, you know, pre and post 1990 are sort of differently bad, and that actually the gangsterish Albanian incarnation in many respects is worse. But what I kind of most enjoyed about reading those passages were the sort of your droll remarks about language, that what, you know, one day your school textbook is full of Leninism and Marxism, and then it's sort of hastily rewritten, and it's about structural reform and economies and the new language of the marketplace, which seems as kind of leaden and ridiculous as the old stuff, almost, the way you tell it. I mean, is that how you saw it?
I think, yeah, I wanted to talk about the power of ideology in a way in shaping the world and the way we understand the world, and in kind of creating the interpretive categories with which you interrogate everything that surrounds you. And I think it was a little bit like that, because it's true that, you know, under communism, there was censorship. And so there was some discourses that you either didn't have access to, or you had access to with great difficulty. And there were books that you couldn't read. And then eventually, I remember in 1990, people were literally burning books. They were burning Marx and they were burning Lenin and everything that they had in their libraries. And everybody was really excited about Hayek and Friedman and von Mises. And they're all the kind of Austrians were suddenly discovered. And I remember this, because I remember my family, which was unusual in the way in which they responded to all these things. My dad was saying, well, we don't burn books. That was very, you know, as a child, first I was very committed communist, and then I became a very committed capitalist. So I decided to participate in this kind of mass burning of the books in the neighborhood. And I remember I rushed home to try and get the Enver Hoxha book that I had to try and burn it. And my dad was like, no, we don't burn books. No, we don't, even if it's Enver Hoxha.
Not even him.
But there was a sense, and afterwards, when I reflect on this, I think there was a sense in which you can't live, it's very hard to live without an ideology. It's almost like faith or like religion or something. You know, you need a system of belief somehow. And I think that it was this transition from one belief structure to another belief structure that was really sudden, and which meant that people didn't really have time to elaborate the interpretive categories with which they might develop a criticism of society, or, you know, question what they were getting into. And so it's true, for example, that we had political pluralism, but we didn't have a single anti-system party that emerged in 1990. They were all basically committed to this new world of freedom and democracy. And so, yeah, I think that's a there was a sense in which we had had a dictatorship of the proletariat, and then we didn't have that category anymore. But what we did have was the new civil society, or that, you know, we didn't have, the party didn't protect us, but we had the Open Society Institute, for example, that was giving opportunities to everyone to flourish and find their roots in this new liberal society.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You ended up becoming a professor of political theory and teaching Marx, and you write about your mother basically kind of rolling her eyes, but both at your choice of profession, philosophy, and at your particular choice to sort of teach Marxism. I mean, why did you do that? I mean, what were you thinking?
It's interesting because for me, it was a way of recovering a story about freedom and about the left, which I felt had been obscured in communist Albania as much as there had been censorship of, you know, liberalism and of free market structures and so on. So I felt I was curious. And I remember I decided to study philosophy. My parents were really hostile to this choice because they associated philosophy to Marxism. And they hated Marxists because effectively in communist Albania, being a Marxist meant being someone who was reporting on them or someone who was, you know, in a party and a spy. And so they were extremely hostile to philosophy because they were hostile to Marxism. And I had promised that I would study philosophy, but I would steer away from Marx. But then eventually I went to Italy, I studied in Rome, and I was hanging out with, I was an immigrant in Italy. So even though I came from this kind of upper class Albanian family, when you go to Italy, you're in 1990, you're just one of the many Albanians who go to Italy. And, you know, immediately you become a target of, these were the years in which there was lots of racism and lots of stereotypization of Albanians, because there had been all these waves of Albanian immigrants, you know, in Italy in the 90s. And so basically being an Albanian in the 90s in Italy was like being someone who would steal money or, you know, be really suspicious, or there was lots of racism. So basically that meant that the people that I became friends with were the ones who were extremely keen to show me that they were very open to immigrants and they loved, you know, Albanians and so on. So almost went the other way, which meant they were usually from the kind of far left or something like that. And the thing that I had all these friends from the left. And the thing that was really interesting was that every time we celebrated, they did these reading groups on Marx and so on, and they invited me to these reading groups. And I kept thinking about my childhood and about my moral education teacher and what we knew about Marx in school, which had been, you know, very simplified and for children, but I still somehow related them to my childhood and to my background. And the thing that I remember drew me almost into this whole literature and this way of thinking was their responses, which was, well, what you had wasn't really socialism, and, you know, this isn't really Marx. You thought you had an interest in Marx and you thought you understood Marx, but actually you were really mistaken. And for me, that was a bit like a kind of an instance of almost liberal paternalism in the way in which you approach the people who come from the periphery, and you just tell them, well, you know, we know better than you what's development, and we know better than
I was going to say liberal paternalism. I mean, that's a very polite way of putting it. I mean, it struck me as being incredibly patronizing and annoying. I'm surprised you didn't kind of punch your co-leftists on the nose, actually, and tell them off.
Well, I mean, no, I'm very tolerant of disagreement. So it's not that I was just perplexed, because I felt that, you know, we celebrated the same heroes and that there were the same books that people thought were interesting and persuasive and worth reading. But I somehow approached Das Kapital with a completely different way of relating to it from how people approach. So there were other people there who would approach this as this kind of almost like a religious text who had the truth, and this truth needed to be realized. And for me, that truth had actually been tried and tested. And in fact, I was feeling guilty because my mom was saying to me, why are you reading this book? This book is responsible for all the horrible things that happened to us. And in some ways, it wasn't entirely untrue, because whenever I read, I remember reading Das Kapital, and I remember reading about, you know, how people were treated as personifications of economic categories, something in this introduction that really struck me. And I kept thinking, well, these are not just economic categories. This is my family. You know, there's my great-grandfather who was a property owner, and my other grandfather was, you know, a capitalist who had factories and was exploiting workers. And then there were all the peasants that my grandmother had been sent to labor camp with and somehow never identified with, and she kept kind of being very superior about. But basically, I just couldn't relate to these as just abstract categories. There was something that you needed to understand about the way in which these texts turn into people and turn into histories and turn into political visions. And there's something that you can learn from engaging with the way in which these political visions are enacted that I think is really important if you're thinking, especially if you're thinking that there is value to the critique still. And so for me, it was a really perplexing attitude, this sort of leftist rejection of everything that came from Eastern Europe as, this is not really socialism. Our socialism, when we do it, is going to be great, and there will be no bloodshed and no violence, and it's going to be amazing. And your socialism, it's because you're so backward and so primitive, and somehow you got it all wrong, and now we need to tell you what it's like. I'm simplifying, but this is how I felt at the time. And I felt that this was not the mature attitude to take to history. It's not to say, well, when I do it, it's going to be better. When these guys did it, it was all a mistake. And that you need to think about, okay, what from ideas filters in societies and how does it filter and what is it in their conditions and in their histories that makes them the societies that they are, and that it requires a more nuanced approach, I guess, which is why I became then attracted to leftist and socialist thinking, because I felt there was something to the critique of capitalism, which I had also lived and I had felt through, and I was convinced by a lot of the arguments around commodification, around exploitation, around exclusion of people from the margins and so on, around the fact that basically this is a capitalist society that doesn't give you a full account of freedom. But then on the other hand, I was also aware of how this all gets distorted and how it becomes part of a very repressive state system, and that it requires very nuanced and sophisticated approach to what you mean by democracy and how do you democratize society. And in fact, I also felt, this is the last thing I'll say about this, I also felt that what was lost in our engagement with the dissident movements in Eastern Europe of the 90s was the fact that the critique of state socialism was very quickly conflated with an endorsement of free market economies. And I don't think in a lot of Eastern European dissident movements, what there was is fundamental critique of democracy in their societies and a desire for a change and something different. But the something different wasn't necessarily free market economy and structural reform and shock therapy and neoliberal economics that we got eventually. And I felt it was really important to tell that story as a story of recovery of this kind of genuine spirit of democratization of the 90s.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a heap of questions, and we should try and kind of blitz through them. I've got a question saying that you thought Albania had democracy and freedom when you were in school. Why did you think that? Was it all propaganda, or were there things that were free and democratic about the communist system?
No, I don't think there was anything that was free and democratic about the Albanian communist system. But what I think there was there was a critique of the outside world. And there were things that were being said about other countries, about capitalist countries, for example, about, you know, the exploitation that existed in other parts of the world, or about unequal development, or about child labor, which I think were and are still true. So there was a sense in which what was going on in Albania, I think, was fundamentally flawed and wrong and brutal and oppressive. But there was a story about the outside world that was being told in Albania, which had some overlaps with, I think, some things that are still true. And so this is what, when I talk about Albanian society, when I don't want to talk just about the repression and the brutality and the kind of the official state propaganda. I also want to talk about the way in which discourses about the outside world shape the sensitivities of ordinary people. And so I don't want to tell the story when I tell about the story of Albanian socialism, just of the state structures and of the state repression. I also want to talk about society and human relations and ideas of solidarity that flourished in hardship and so on. And that's where I think you could recover this idea that there was a parallel freedom, which wasn't necessarily the freedom brought by the state, but which was almost like a freedom that even that repressive state couldn't kill in a way, and that was there in human relations.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the solidarity when standing for a queue, and that people would respect other people going off and replacing themselves with a stone or a pot or something and come back again, that actually neighbours looked out for each other. And I mean, that's all delightfully done. I've got an interesting question here, which says, basically, how are you viewed in Albania? And might I add, you know, what's the reaction been in Albania to your book?
Well, I guess it's... It's a little bit less positive than in the rest of the world, let's say. So while I don't want to over-labor this point or overdo it, but I think because it has had such universal acclaim in everywhere else apart from Albania, I'd say that the only one or two critical reviews, very critical reviews that there have been of the book have been in Albania. And in part because I think the discourse around the past and historical injustice in particular, Albania is still very much a divided society that suffers from this legacy of historical unsettling of accounts in a way. And there is constantly an effort to find responsibilities and to talk about the past, but in this very complex network of responsibilities in a way where, you know, everybody was both a victim and an oppressor, and people had spies in their family, or, you know, there were honest people, both among party officials and amongst kind of former victims of the regime. And there were people who would be nasty and harm others that also on both sides of society. So it is a very complex society, which is very divided in part because of this complexity of responsibility. And so to talk about the past in a way that is nuanced, and more importantly, the way which I try to do in my book, which is to just let lots of different voices talk and have lots of different ways of telling the story.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a radio play or a drama. It is a memoir. It's all true. But you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I made a very conscious effort because I knew, and this is also partly why there is this child, and the book is written in the voice of a child, because I think to have a child character, it's almost like, you know, you have the tin drum, or there's these characters in the history of literature where you have a kind of naive character that records the complexity of the world around them. And because the main character is so naive, you could have lots of different stories and lots of different interpretations that play out. And because I didn't want to write the book as a political philosopher, and so I didn't don't want to be paternalistic with the readers in terms of telling them this is how you should interpret reality, and this is how you should interpret communism, and this is how you should interpret liberalism. I just wanted to tell different stories of different people and talk about different conceptions of freedom, and then let the reader draw their own conclusions and join the conversation in a way. And somehow this has worked everywhere except for Albania, where there has been skepticism to the extent that my motives were questioned, because nobody believes that I really wanted to do that, and that they all think that there was some kind of surreptitious effort to tell something much more complex than that, and that there was a kind of deep truth that my book is trying to convey about communism and about liberalism. And that's, I think, what has in part reflected in the criticisms and, say, in some of the reviews, where people are always trying to find the kind of, what is my fundamental commitment, when in fact my fundamental commitment is made very clear in the epilogue. I mean, I say this, the epilogue is the only part of the book where the author really emerges and says what they think about the world. And so, and in the rest, I didn't want to have my own views imposed on the reader, and I just wanted to let different people tell their stories, as I say, and write a very open book and be as true as possible, because I thought it was really important, if you write a book about freedom, that you write it in respect, in a way that respects the freedom of people when they read it, and that you don't write it in this paternalistic way. So this was all very conscious, very deliberate on my side, but somehow it hasn't quite worked in Albania.
Leah, just a quick follow-up to that, which I think is kind of interesting. Maria says, you know, where is Albanian society now? Is the nostalgia for the communist years, or is it seen in a negative light? Just do me one minute on that.
I think it's less nostalgic than other countries. I think there's more nostalgia about the communist years in Eastern Europe. But there's certainly, when I talk to people, when I talk to taxi drivers, or when I go to Albania and sort of try and get the word on the street, people would say, oh, there were more hospitals here, and, you know, this we didn't have this, or there was more solidarity back then. And so there are a sense in which people are nostalgic about certain aspects of not so much communism, but life in common under communism, and about their social relations and what they have lost. The fact that, you know, this is a society that is now a society of emigrants, and there's lots of people who have left their homes, and so the families have been disrupted by this process. And so there is a sense in which, I guess, many miss community. And but I don't think there is, you know, a desire to return to having communist Albania in the way in which, you know, communist Albania would have been part of this, in the way in which the state story about communist Albania would have been. I don't think there's any nostalgia for the anti-imperialist lighthouse, let's say.
Okay, another interesting question here. Do you feel that being a woman shaped your view of freedom? And I would just add to that question, I mean, there are very many strong women in your book, particularly your grandmother and, of course, your mother. I mean, is it got anything to do with gender, or is it just to do with you?
No, this is a very good question. It's a very interesting question, also because it's a question that's unsettled in my mind as well. I feel that I discovered gender really, really late in my life, actually, in part because I grew up with these very strong women for whom being a woman was never singled out as in any way important. My mom was definitely the kind of dominant parent, and so she was never struggling for, you know, voice in the family and also in society more generally. She was, my grandmother was the same. She's very strong. So I had these very strong role models. And also in Albania, the rhetoric in communist Albania was that women would formally do everything that men did. So they would work in mines, and they would work in every state job. There were no women that stayed at home. So formally, it was a very equal society, equal both in its opportunities and in its oppression. So you would oppress equally men and women, and you would and you would give opportunities in some ways. It wasn't quite like that. When I thought about it afterwards, and I have this chapter in a book in which I try to reflect on questions of gender a bit more, I felt that when I thought about this afterwards, it wasn't quite like that, because it's true that they were officially, formally equal, but it's also, there was a legacy of the past, and which meant that women actually did most of the domestic labor. And so women did, yes, outside all the state jobs like men, so they would be drivers, drive truck drivers, train drivers, work in the mines, be engineers, whatever. But then they would also come home and look after the children all the time, and they would wake up at 5 a.m. I had all these friends who didn't have grandmothers who lived with them, and so couldn't share with grandparents the domestic labor. And they would, you know, their mothers would wake up at 4 a.m. and clean the houses frantically until it was time to go to work, and then they'd go to work and then come back and then look after the children. So basically they did everything. So I think it's a complex, it was a complex question. And it's not one that, as I say, because I was never urged to reflect on from very early on, and because my mother also had this very hostile attitude to tokenism. So at one point she was the leader of a women's organization in Albania in the 90s, which was a kind of opposition women. And her job was to try and get visas for the mothers of immigrants. And she hated the fact that these working class women weren't given visas because they were seen as suspicious. But on the other hand, her association was told all the time to kind of do affirmative action. And she was like, what is this affirmative action? I don't get it. I hate this stuff. I don't care about it. Why are they not giving the visas to my working mothers? You know, these are women who want to see their children. And somehow she felt that the way in which she was, the way in which these decisions were made were very arbitrary and very tokenistic and very superficial. And so I had grown up seeing that. And I think part of me was quite hostile as well to this tokenistic way of talking about gender questions without thinking of all the relationships. And my mom was very resentful. You know, she kept saying this embassy official who didn't give me my visa for my women in my organization, I bet, you know, his wife jogs all the time and someone else does her care work. And so she had all these kind of ways of thinking about domestic labor and distribution, which weren't just about gender. They were often also about class and about, you know, distribution of power and so on. So I think, so I don't know what being a woman has done to me, because I feel like it's an ongoing process of reflection that I only really started thinking clearly about very, very late in my life, that I didn't grow up with this awareness.
Okay, interesting answer. So look, another question here about whether basically the Albanian experience of transition to democracy in inverted commas, how similar was that to what other, you know, Eastern, or I guess you call them Central European countries, went through, like East Germany, for example, or Hungary or Romania? I mean, what was the Albanian experience, the same, or was it different?
I think because the experience of communism was very, very radical and very, very different and much more austere in a way, I think the transition to liberalism was also in some ways more radical and more austere and harder. But when I gave my books to friends from Eastern Europe, and now I get lots of emails from readers from Eastern Europe who always say to me, well, I grew up in Poland, but I really recognize your childhood. We all had bubblegum wrappers. And I feel there is a sort of a category of the ex-communist ex-child that is a kind of general identity, which cuts across national boundaries. And so I get lots of, as I say, Romanians or people across the Soviet Union writing to me and saying, yeah, we had this as well. And we had these state classes where we were told about the proletariat. And so some of the categories were obviously similar. And I think what I've also noticed is that the sense in which liberalism turned out to be a betrayal is also widespread in Eastern Europe, which I think perhaps explains some of the hostility that you now see in a lot of East European countries to basically liberal institutions and to this kind of liberalizing effort. I feel that the transition took its toll in many of these states. And I mean, you could also, if you read Svetlana Alexievich, for example, who talks about the Soviet Union and so on, some of these experiences of transition were equally harsh and equally a disappointment for people in these other parts of Eastern Europe, not just in Albania. And I think that has meant that people have become much more skeptical. And to me, and this is where I part ways, I guess, with most East Europeans, almost too skeptical and too nihilistic about any possibility and any alternative and any sense of you could believe in anything after these two massive historical disappointments, you know, first with socialism and then with liberalism. I feel like people can't quite, they can always see the criticism, but they can't quite believe in anything constructive. And I feel that for me, that's not the case, but that's only because I guess I'm a Kantian and so I'm philosophically committed to seeing something positive.
Yeah. I mean, you end up in a sort of Putinish kind of nihilistic place where there's no truth and no value and no anything really other than kind of sovereign power and force. Listen, we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you one question about writers, about which other writers you admire. And, you know, when you were putting this book together, what you were sort of reading to kind of, I guess, you know, fertilize, protonize your imagination. I mean, tell us about your writing world a bit.
Yeah, so I have always been a great reader. And so it wasn't so much that I was reading when I was writing things that would put me in the mood for writing this book. It's more that I sort of recovered all the different things that I had been attracted in. And I guess I can, you know, if I talk about writers, I think I could divide it in phases, in stages almost. If I think about my childhood, because I grew up with very little television, I was into classical Greek literature. So like I was reading a lot of Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles, and I was obsessed with Greek tragedies and Greek myths because, you know, I couldn't get my head around the fact that Greek gods were both powerful and powerless at the same time. So that was my sort of first range of influence really came from this kind of classical Greek myths world, basically. And also all this, you know, these tragedies that are somehow tragedies about discovering the truth and so on, I felt they probably were quite important in the way in which I was thinking about literary techniques and so on. And then when I was growing up as a teenager, I became really interested in Dostoevsky and 19th century Russian literature, especially so Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. And I think partly because they were gravitating, all these authors were gravitating around these same themes of kind of freedom and necessity, which are also part of this Greek myth that I was talking about. And at some point I was reading, in 1997, I was reading War and Peace. And I remember that War and Peace ends with this kind of big sweeping critique of the philosophy of history, where, you know, Tolstoy tries to show how it's pointless to try and reconstruct meaning in history. And I remember that that was what made me decide to study philosophy, this kind of thinking about this line and thinking, well, is it true that there's no meaning in history? And is it true that there's no, that it's just these thousands of different actions and reactions mean that it's all kind of absurd? And then I guess this was my, in terms of literature, this is my world, this 19th century novels, and in particular classical Russian, sort of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky range, and Turgenev to some extent as well. And then the last influence is philosophical, and that's more my studies and kind of almost foundational. In the book, I'm really interested in Enlightenment philosophical tradition, and especially in Kant and Marx. And most of my work is trying to show that there is an overlap in these philosophical traditions and ideas of Kant that tell us what's the right thing to do and how to think about morality, that can be combined productively with ideas of Marx around critiques of existing societies, and that give you a good foundation from which to think about the future and to think about sort of future social systems in a way. But yeah, it's a combination of literature and German, Russian literature, I'd say, and German philosophy.
We're practically out of time, but one very quick question, which I want to know the answer to. Give me a quick answer. Is there going to be a follow-up? I mean, I would love to read more. I mean, you must have more diaries, more material. It's been such a success. Can you tell us? Will you do a follow-up, a sequel?
I don't know. I'm thinking about both a prequel and a sequel. So the sequel, if I do one, if I do a sequel, it will be called Equal. And so there will be a free and an equal. And Equal would be about my part in Italy and my experiences as an immigrant of a kind of upper-class Albanian family. Being an immigrant in Italy, and my experiences of poverty and oppression, fighting for scholarships and stuff like that. But I think, but maybe what I will do next is actually a prequel, which will be around my grandmother and her life in this transition and the interwar years in the Balkans, and the influence of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire on this emergence of nation states in the Balkans, and these ideas of liberalism and fascism and socialism, which were all there in the interwar period, which I think are really important also to understand the current predicament, because I think there's always a comparison between now and the 1930s, 1929, the crisis, financial crisis, and this kind of birth of different ideologies and all these debates around reform and revolution, which I'd like to talk about, hopefully maybe using again the same sort of literary techniques. So,
well, I mean, I can't wait. I can't wait. Well, listen,
see if it works. Magic works again.
The magic is strong. It sounds like something out of Star Wars, but anyway, it's going to be great, a prequel and a sequel. So, Leia, thank you very much. It's been a delightful conversation. It's such a brilliant book. Just for anyone who hasn't read it or, you know, is thinking about ordering it, here it is. It's just exquisite and funny and profound. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for the conversation.